Hi there, I'm Chris Kessling, and welcome to Defence Barrister, the podcast on understanding and surviving criminal trials, sentencing, and appeals. Today, in episode 6, we are continuing on our journey through the criminal justice system in England and Wales, with our three defendants, Aidan, Bianca and Connor, all heading inexorably towards trial before a judge and jury in the Crown Court, a trial which will begin in episode 7. All face a joint charge of murdering 23-year-old Daniel Clarke during a fight outside a nightclub, during which Daniel was hit in the face with a broken bottle and died in hospital later the same day. To sum up where we are, in episode 1, we started with the crime, or at least the allegation of a crime, which led to the arrest and detention of the three people now accused of that crime: Aidan Johnson, Bianca Jones and Connor Williams. In episode 2, we saw what joint enterprise means in law and how the charging process works, as well as how Aidan, Bianca and Connor answered questions or chose not to answer questions during their police interviews under caution. What implications follow from the approaches they took remains to be seen. Then, in episode 3, following Daniel's death, we focused on the offence of murder, what the offence of murder actually means and what defences or partial defences to murder are available, and what, like here, happens when there are actually multiple causes of death. We looked at situations where a defendant can be said to have caused a death, and when other factors break the link between the initial act of a defendant and the eventual outcome. And then, in episode 4, after all three defendants were charged with murder, we followed them to the magistrates' court for their first appearance, and were introduced to our two-tier system of criminal justice, the magistrates' court and the Crown Court, as well as to those offences the courts deal with and how some cases, such as murder, must proceed to the Crown Court for trial. And to bring us up to speed, in episode 5, we met the barristers representing Aidan, Bianca and Connor and looked in far more detail at the criminal lawyers, barristers and solicitors who keep the criminal justice system alive and kicking. Also, in episode 5, we saw the approach the courts take to deciding whether to remand a defendant on bail or to remand them in custody, and how the approach taken to granting bail in murder cases is far stricter than for other offences. And what was the outcome of the bail application in our case? In short, Aidan and Connor were remanded in custody, and Bianca was released on bail with a number of stringent conditions attached. As we'll see, in murder cases, as in many criminal cases, things are not always as they appear, and unexpected events occur. And this case is no exception. Just one hint of this appeared at the end of the last episode where, just before Connor returned to his cell, he said to Bianca, "Do the right thing, you know what you did." What will come of this we'll discover as the trial unfolds. And that's not all, since something else will happen during this episode which will have significant implications for both the prosecution and defence as this case goes to trial. But before I move on, one listener with a keen ear for detail has already brought to my attention an error in the last episode where the judge referred to Bianca by the wrong surname, calling her Bianca Williams instead of Bianca Jones. Is that my fault? Absolutely not. I blame the judge. But seriously, thank you for pointing out the error. In fact, in the podcast summary and notes, I've listed the names of all the characters in this podcast, including the witnesses for the prosecution and the witnesses for the defence, and the barristers and solicitors acting for Aidan, Bianca and Connor. I'll also send it to the judge as a gentle reminder. As I've mentioned before, although this podcast uses up-to-date law and procedure and relies on a criminal case which is typical of its kind, all names here are nonetheless fictitious, and no identification with actual people, either living or deceased, is intended or should be inferred. So that's where we are now. In this episode, I want to focus on evidence and the potential problems with evidence when putting a case together. Since without evidence, there can be no proof. How do the prosecution prove a case? And how do they go about building a case which is strong enough to convince a jury to convict? And how, on the other hand, do the defence prepare a case? How do they approach their task of defining the defence and preparing to undermine the prosecution evidence to such an extent that the jury will find a defendant not guilty of the crime they're charged with. During this episode, and when soon the trial starts, we'll find out. And what happens if a defendant or prosecution witness has previous convictions or some other troubling past? We'll look at this too, at what is known as bad character evidence and the implications it can have for a case going to trial. We know that at the end of the last hearing, the first appearance at the Crown Court for Aidan, Bianca and Connor, the judge set a date for the plea and trial preparation hearing and also gave further directions about service of the prosecution case. The plea and trial preparation hearing, or PTPH, is for most cases the first hearing in the Crown Court. But for Aidan, Bianca and Connor, who all face a murder charge, it'll be their second. In a nutshell, at the PTPH, the indictment is put to the defendants and they're asked to plead either guilty or not guilty. If guilty, the case moves forward to sentence. If not guilty, the case moves forward to trial. If it's going to trial, then there's a complex form to fill out and the judge will give various directions about service of evidence and other matters in the expectation that when the trial date is reached, the trial will in fact be ready to go ahead. So that's why it's called the plea and trial preparation hearing. In fact, this hearing has had lots of names over the years. When I started as a criminal barrister in the early 90s, it was called a plea and directions hearing, or PDH. It then became a plea and case management hearing, or PCMH, and now it's a plea and trial preparation hearing, or PTPH. But whatever it's called, its purpose is to ensure trial readiness for defendants who plead not guilty to the allegation or allegations they face. At the Magistrates' Court, we looked in episode 4 at how the magistrates at the first hearing triage cases depending on how the offence they're dealing with is classified. For cases they decide will be tried in the Magistrates' Court, known as summary trials, they then go through a similar case management procedure to the PTPH, during which directions are given to ensure the case is ready for summary trial. But in our case, the next hearing will be the Crown Court PTPH, when the indictment will be put. So what's an indictment? Simply put, it's the document which contains the allegations a defendant faces. An indictment only exists in the Crown Court, hence the term trial on indictment. In the magistrates, the equivalent document is the charge sheet. Each individual offence on the indictment is known as a count. And each count has two parts, which are the statement of offence, which sets out the name of the offence, and the particulars of offence, which sets out a very brief summary of the allegation. Our defendants are facing a single count of murder, so the indictment will read, statement of offence, murder, particulars of offence, Aidan Johnson, Bianca Jones and Connor Williams on the 27th of January 2024, murdered Daniel Clark. And that's it. That's the document which represents the trial which Aidan, Bianca and Connor will face. The reason that there's only one count on this indictment is that it's a joint charge. They are all alleged to be jointly responsible for a single offence, Daniel's murder. And for that reason, there is no need for individual separate counts against them. There's no rule governing the order in which multiple defendants appear on an indictment. The prosecution will often decide this in a way which makes most sense in presenting the case to a jury effectively, which often, as here, means putting the principal player first and then the secondary participants further down. So that's the indictment, but what of the evidence? By the time of the PTPH, the judge will be looking to see that the case is in some state of fitness to proceed to trial, and the prosecution will be hoping that they have all the evidence they need or are simply seeking some additional matters to tidy the case up and perhaps fill in a few gaps. There are, of course, some rules about getting a case prepared for trial. I mentioned previously that criminal court procedure is principally governed by the criminal procedure rules and also by criminal practice directions. The Criminal Practice Directions 2023 Direction 5.2 requires that an indictment should be uploaded to the digital case management system at least 7 days in advance of the PTPH and that the time allowed to conduct the PTPH is sufficient for effective trial preparation. The digital case management system is something that lawyers and the court have access to. But if you're representing yourself, you would have to rely on using, in inverted commas, normal documents, usually in PDF, Word or paper form. It's a real problem for unrepresented defendants, but in this scenario, since all of our defendants have lawyers, they will all send and receive documents via the digital case management system. Nonetheless, for those that are interested, I've put a link to a PTPH form in the podcast notes, as well as multiple other documents so that you can see them for yourselves. The Criminal Practice Directions 2023 Direction 5.2 also provides that where a defendant was remanded in custody after being charged and sent for trial without service of full initial details of the prosecution case, they're entitled, as a minimum, to all of the following information from the prosecution at least 7 days before the PTPH. First, a summary of the circumstances of the offence, including any interview account. This is something all three of our defendants have received. Second, statements and exhibits the prosecution has identified as important for plea or initial case management, including CCTV relied upon and any streamlined forensic reports. None of these things has been received, and we'll look more at these in a moment. Third, witness availability. This is required to set a trial date, or as in our case, where a provisional trial date has already been set to ensure that all witnesses are able to attend. Fourth, the defendant's criminal record. These have been provided. We found out in the last episode that Connor's criminal record was incomplete and this has now been updated. Fifth, victim personal statements, if they're available. These usually refer to the impact an offence has had on the victim. In a murder case, of course, the fact of death means that the victim will be unable to provide such a statement. So instead, it will be from close family or partners about the impact on them of the death. Sixth, an indication of any likely prosecution expert evidence. Some of this has been provided, and we'll also look at this in a moment. Seventh, information as to special measures, bad character or hearsay where applicable. These are additional issues which the prosecution will need to give thought to. I'll explain what they all mean as we move forward to gathering evidence and preparation of the prosecution case. So let's turn to gathering evidence and preparation of that case, the prosecution case. At multiple stages already, there will have been an analysis of the strength of the prosecution case and of what additional evidence is required. We know that from an early stage, the police were seeking more evidence, a process that stepped up when it became known that Daniel had died. More evidence has now been recovered. The CPS lawyers and the prosecution barrister will be looking at the evidence and asking themselves one fundamental question. Is this evidence sufficient to convict these defendants on a charge of murder? In doing so, they'll have the burden and standard of proof at the forefront of their minds. The burden of proof is this, that the prosecution bring the case and it's for the prosecution to prove it. And the standard of proof? Well, in criminal cases, proof is held to the highest standard, which is beyond reasonable doubt. And that's often explained to juries in criminal cases is you have to be satisfied so that you are sure of guilt. And then they'll look at the offence they're seeking to prove, the charge of murder. Can we, the prosecution, prove to this high standard that these three defendants caused the death of Daniel Clark and did so either intending to kill him or to cause him really serious harm? It means that in preparing the prosecution case for trial, the lawyers will look critically at the evidence they have. Where is it strong and where is it weak? If there are holes, how do we fill them? And in the end, once we've looked at everything, do we have a case that's fit to be placed before a jury? The starting point is therefore to look at the offence. What does the prosecution have to prove? And the next stage is to look at the evidence. Is the prosecution evidence sufficient to prove it to the standard required? So let's look over the evidence. As was mentioned in Aidan's interview, the police checked for CCTV from the club, as well as investigating whether there was any further CCTV, such as from local shops or private homes, that might have captured the fight outside the nightclub or any additional evidence of interest. What the police were looking for from CCTV inside the club was anything that might have shown the initial fight, or anything that might have shown Aidan, Bianca and Connor leaving holding a bottle. After all, if they could show any one of the three defendants with a bottle, it would support the prosecution contention that one of them used it on the victim. In fact, their investigations have taken them no further. Nothing was captured of the fight inside the club. There is CCTV inside the foyer of the club, but the camera was angled towards the entrance door. It means that when Aidan and Daniel, who were the first to leave, are seen being ushered out by security, they can only be seen from behind and their hands are not visible. They're also partially obscured by the security staff themselves. It therefore doesn't prove that either had a bottle, but it also, perhaps helpfully, doesn't suggest that they didn't. When Bianca and then Connor are seen to leave moments later, Bianca's left hand can be seen not to be holding anything, but her right hand is out of view. Connor has both hands in his pockets. Inquiries in the locality and requests for dashcam footage also have not revealed anything. There's plenty of CCTV of Aidan, Bianca and Connor running from the scene as they're captured by multiple CCTV cameras across town, but none of this shows anything other than their attempted escape and their clothing and general appearance. Just as witnesses described them, and we'll get to witnesses in a moment, Aidan is a white male in his early 20s with dark hair and wearing a pink shirt. Bianca Jones is a white female of a similar age, slim build with long dark hair and wearing a green top. And Connor is a black male, also early 20s, stocky build with short dark hair and wearing a white t-shirt. We know that there was an initial failure before this became a murder investigation to collect much physical evidence from the scene. And many fragments of glass from the bottle, which could have been collected, were widely dispersed by people both arriving at and leaving the club. However, a neck of a bottle was recovered, and it was tested for DNA and fingerprints against samples from Aidan, Bianca and Connor. Again, this was inconclusive, since no prints or partial prints on the bottle were of sufficient quality to test for fingerprints, and no DNA sample, with one exception, could be obtained. Although an explanation was given by the analyst that since only a small part of the neck of a bottle was recovered, anyone holding the bottle could have been holding another part of it or could have been wearing gloves, a distinct possibility given the time of year. Upon receiving this report, the police had gone back to the CCTV, both inside and outside the club, to see if any of the defendants were wearing gloves. For the reasons mentioned, neither Aidan, Connor or Daniel's hands were visible on the CCTV inside the club, and Bianca's single left hand with no glove could be seen. But from the images of the defendants running from the scene, they showed Bianca at that stage to be wearing gloves. It follows that she put at least one glove on after leaving the club. I mentioned one exception to a DNA sample being found on the bottle. There was, in fact, blood on the bottle, and this was clearly matched to the deceased Daniel Clark. It meant that the prosecution could say with a high degree of certainty that the bottle recovered was, in fact, the murder weapon, even if this fell far short of the equivalent of a smoking gun seen in the hands of the person accused of a killing. Another reason for being able to identify this bottle as the murder weapon was the linking of tiny glass fragments removed from the wounds in the face of the deceased with the piece of bottle recovered. This was done by testing the refractive index of the glass fragments and comparing them with the refractive index of the glass from the bottle, a technique which essentially tests how fast a light beam travels through a medium, in this case the glass, compared with through a vacuum. Such is the precision of this technique that, again, the bottle could be said with certainty to be the murder weapon. In fact, despite losing many fragments, careful examination of the crime scene did allow for much of the bottle to be recovered. But the many parts were extremely small, had in some cases been trampled underfoot, and nothing of any further evidential value was recovered from them. All of this evidence will be placed in the form of what's often referred to as a streamlined forensic report, which can then be served as evidence on the defence. This sort of streamlined report summarises the scientific evidence. if the defence agrees with it, then there's no need for a full and more detailed report. But if the defence disagree with it, then a full and comprehensive report will be provided, at least concerning those parts which are in dispute. Moving to the medical evidence. Following Daniel Clark's death, a full post-mortem report was obtained and served on the defence, and the defence in due course commissioned their own post-mortem, which was in agreement with the first. As we saw in episode 3, the cause of death was complex, but there was no room reasonably to suggest that the injury caused by the bottle was not a substantial and operating cause of death, and therefore to say that the person responsible for using the bottle was not responsible for the death that followed. To this extent, the prosecution can say that the person who pushed the broken bottle into Daniel's face caused his death, and this will not be an issue at the trial. Let's move now from medical evidence to factual witnesses who were present at the scene. We know that statements were taken from Daniel's two friends, Ethan, full name Ethan Green, and Finn, full name Finn Hawkins. A formal statement for use in a criminal court is known by lawyers as a Section 9 statement, and this comes from Section 9 of the Criminal Justice Act 1967. Section 9 states that if, when a statement is taken from a witness, the formalities in the section are complied with, then the statement itself can be used in evidence at court unless another party in the case, usually a defendant, objects to the statement being read and instead wishes the witness to attend. Criminal Procedure Rule 16.2 also sets out these formalities. The point is this: if a defendant has no issue with the contents of a witness statement, then there's no need to call that witness to court to give evidence. But where the contents are disputed, then the defendant will want that witness to attend and to be cross-examined on their account of what took place. The formalities of a Section 9 statement are that the statement contains the name of the witness, is signed by him or her, and contains this declaration. The declaration is this: this statement is true to the best of my knowledge and belief, and I make it knowing that, if it is tendered in evidence, I shall be liable to prosecution if I have willfully stated in it anything which I know to be false or do not believe to be true. If the person who has given the statement can't read, then there must be a signed declaration by someone else that they read the statement out to the witness. This declaration really amounts to a warning, a recognition of the seriousness of giving a statement in a criminal case, the undertaking that the statement must be true to the best of the witness's knowledge and belief, and a recognition that deliberately lying or misleading a court can amount to a criminal offence. This could amount to an offence under Section 89 of the Criminal Justice Act 1967 of providing a false witness statement with a maximum penalty of 2 years imprisonment, or an offence of perverting the course of justice, a common law offence, with a maximum sentence of life imprisonment, or, if a witness actually gives evidence and lies under oath, an offence of perjury, which carries a maximum term of imprisonment of 7 years. Despite the gravity of giving false evidence, simply providing a statement which complies with the formalities of Section 9 does not, of course, guarantee that the statement is true. Whether or not a jury accepts the evidence of a witness will, of course, depend on whether they decide what the witness has said is something they can rely on, or alternatively, something they can't or can't accept enough to be sure of. That falls squarely within what a jury does as judges of the facts, to weigh up and assess the evidence they're presented with, and to do so after the witness has been cross-examined by the opposing party, but more of that soon when we get to trial. Back to this case, and Daniel's two friends, Ethan Green and Finn Hawkins, both gave statements to the police about what occurred early that Saturday morning. As we've already heard, in summary, they both point the finger at Aidan, who they call the man in the pink shirt, saying he started pushing Daniel on the dance floor. The bouncers then got the wrong idea and threw both out. They, Ethan and Finn, followed, only to see pink shirt man going for Daniel, backed up by his two mates, a girl and a shorter man, who were egging him on and shouting threats, including that they were going to kill Daniel, and said Finn, cut him up. All of a sudden, They heard the sound of a bottle smashing, and out of nowhere, it was pushed straight into Daniel's face, cutting his face into pieces. There was blood everywhere. Ethan said it was Pink Shirt Man that did it, and Finn that Pink Shirt Man must have done it. His mates were laughing and cheering, then they just legged it. Ethan chased for a while instinctively, he said, but then returned to where Finn was with Daniel, who lay unmoving and bleeding so heavily that he thought Daniel was dead. Ethan and Finn are key prosecution witnesses. They both heard the bottle smash. That suggests, coupled with the subsequent use of that bottle, at the very least an intention to cause really serious harm, an intention which is sufficient to make out the mental element, the mens rea, of the offence of murder. There's no suggestion that anyone else in a pink shirt was involved in the fight, so it naturally follows that Pink Shirt Man must be Aiden. It means that, far from being passive bystanders or people on the periphery of what was taking place, they were in fact actively encouraging the event which did in fact take place, which falls directly into the classic definition of a joint enterprise. The evidence from Ethan and Finn that Aiden's friends were laughing and cheering after the bottling occurred is useful evidence to suggest their true attitude of malice about what had just occurred. Ethan and Finn's statements will therefore be served as prosecution evidence. Given that there's no chance that their evidence will be accepted by the defendants, the defence will require both Ethan and Finn to attend for trial. This is one of the main things that happens at the PTPH, that the defence notify the prosecution on the PTPH form which prosecution witnesses are required to attend. Much the prosecution are aware will turn on how clearly Ethan and Finn give their evidence and how they stand up to cross-examination, since any prosecution and defence barrister and solicitor knows that what you see on paper in a written witness statement can sometimes be very different to what you get at court. That ultimately will only be known at the trial. But what the prosecution will also look for is whether there's any aspect of a witness which may be seen to undermine the veracity of what they've said, something which the defence may use at trial to undermine their credibility as a witness. And I'll come back to this in a moment, because here the prosecution have a potential problem. The final two factual witnesses are the door staff, or nightclub security, who removed both Aiden and Daniel from the nightclub. Their names are George Ingram and Harvey Jenkins. They've also given witness statements, although those witness statements are lacking in some details. George and Harvey both say that they saw two white males on the dance floor, one with dark hair and a pink shirt fitting the description of Aiden, and another with bright blonde hair and dark clothing fitting the description of Daniel Clark. And they ejected them both. And this is borne out also by the security camera footage from the club foyer. They add that shortly afterwards, they looked out to see what they described as a full-scale brawl occurring, although no detail is included about what exactly they mean or precisely who was involved. Also, as we know, there is no CCTV of the fight which occurred outside. Both George and Harvey say in their statements that as they watched, they saw the same dark-haired male with a pink shirt run off at speed, followed by a girl fitting Bianca's description and another shorter male fitting Connor's description. After that, they lost sight of them. When they crossed over to see the blonde man, they couldn't believe the state his face was in and immediately called 999 for the police and an ambulance. They spoke to the other two males with the blonde man, who told them that Pink Shirt Man had done it with a broken bottle, and they passed this information to the police. Given the lack of clarity about the full-scale brawl, the CPS prosecutor has already asked the police to see both witnesses and obtain further details. This is where the first witness problems arise, because since the incident, both George and Harvey have left their jobs at Bradley's nightclub and moved on. From what the police can gather, local anger at what had occurred turned on them as being the people responsible for throwing Daniel Clark out of the club with the person who was to kill him. Murderers were scrawled across the nightclub doors. If they hadn't moved on voluntarily, they would almost certainly have been asked to do so by the owners. When the police do eventually catch up with George and Harvey, neither shows any interest in supporting the prosecution case. In fact, quite the opposite. They both say they'll have nothing to do with it, didn't see anything, and even if they did, they can no longer remember what it was. The reality is that they feel wounded at their treatment and have turned against providing any form of assistance in this case. As to what the prosecution can now do about this, the prosecution can compel most witnesses to attend court by issuing a witness summons. But it's always dangerous to rely on a witness who you already know is hostile or potentially unfavourable to your case. Sometimes it's better to make the decision early that a witness is unreliable and therefore decide not to use them at all. In fact, the prosecution has a large discretion as to who to use or not to use as witnesses when they're putting their case together. But it can become harder to dispense with a witness once their statement has been served on the defence as part of the prosecution evidence they intend to rely on. If the prosecution serves the witness statement as part of its case, and the defence asks for that witness to attend trial, if the prosecution subsequently, such as during the trial or just before it starts, make the decision to dispense with the witness, the defence can still insist that the prosecution call that witness and tender them for cross-examination. What this means in practice is that at court, after the witness is sworn, i.e. takes the oath or affirms to tell the truth, the prosecution will simply ask their name but no more than that, since they no longer wish to rely on the witness's evidence. They'll therefore tender the witness to the defence, who'll then be able to cross-examine the witness if they choose to do so. In our case, for example, if the statements of George and Harvey were served, the defence requested their attendance and then the prosecution chose not to rely on them, they could both be tendered for cross-examination. The defence might wish, for example, to put to both witnesses that they saw Daniel pushing Aidan on the dance floor to bolster Aidan's case that Daniel was the aggressor. They might also wish to put to both witnesses that they must have seen Daniel and his friends attacking Aidan outside. As useful as that sounds, it comes at a significant risk, since George and Harvey might instead say that Aidan was the aggressor. We simply don't know what they'd say if pushed. And that's the danger of asking a question you don't know the answer to. And with hostile witnesses, the answers received may do your case considerable harm, or at least more harm than good. It's worth bearing in mind that if in the course of an investigation, a witness statement is taken, and despite the prosecution choosing not to use the witness as part of their case, the witness statement actually contains something which may be helpful to the defence, there's then a duty on the prosecution to disclose that statement to the defence. But it would then be for the defence to get that witness to court. This is part of what's known as the prosecution duty to disclose unused material. The long and short of the witness problem is this: George and Harvey have become hostile. Initially, the CPS put large red question marks next to George and Harvey and decide to leave it in the hands of the prosecution barrister who will be conducting the trial to advise them on the best way forward. And when the prosecution barrister looks at it, he takes the view that George and Harvey should be dispensed with, since their evidence lacks detail and has no realistic prospect of being improved, and both are liable to do more harm than good. In addition, he finds out both George and Harvey have a long list of convictions for dishonesty, which could significantly undermine any credibility they might otherwise have. Their statements will therefore be served with the rest of the prosecution case, but as unused material. So, goodbye George and Harvey, unless, that is, the defence decide to call them, which is highly unlikely given that it's very difficult to know what exactly, if anything, they will say. This leads me to another issue that can arise with witnesses, which is a witness that a party wants to rely on but cannot get to court, even with a witness summons. Imagine that a witness has crucial evidence to give and their account is fully set out in a witness statement. But before the case gets to trial, it becomes apparent that the witness will not be able to attend court. This could happen for the obvious reasons that the witness has died or become so ill that they're incapable of giving evidence. Or it could happen because the witness has simply disappeared. And despite all reasonable efforts being made to find them, they simply can't be found. In this situation, can the party seeking to rely on their evidence simply read their written witness statement instead of actually calling the person who made that statement to give evidence? The simple answer is no, because this amounts to what is known as hearsay, which is evidence intending to prove something as true from a witness who is not in court to give that testimony him or herself. For example, imagine that a witness called John gave a statement to the prosecution that he was walking outside the nightclub and saw a person matching Aidan's description stick a broken bottle into the face of someone fitting Daniel's description. He's obviously a crucial witness and the prosecution will want to call him. However, before trial, John disappears. Despite all efforts, he simply can't be located. Inquiries subsequently reveal that he went to Australia intending to stay for as long as he could and is probably somewhere in the outback. In this situation, on the face of it, the prosecution could not just read John's statement to the jury because it amounts to hearsay evidence, which is inadmissible in court. The reason that hearsay is inadmissible is because it's not the best evidence. The best evidence at trial will come from the original witness who can explain not only what they saw or heard, but can also answer any detailed questions about it. If only their written witness statement is available, it won't be possible for the other side, in this example the defence, to cross-examine the witness and potentially to expose flaws or weaknesses in their account of what took place. Occasionally, what appears as compelling evidence on paper is far less compelling when the witness attends and gives evidence at trial. This could be for all manner of reasons, such as the witness originally not telling the truth, exaggerating, filling in the gaps in their own mind, partly relying on what somebody else has told them, or just being mistaken or confused. On the other hand, there are occasions when a witness is far more compelling in person than would ever have been anticipated by reading their witness statement. Either way, where evidence is disputed, the best evidence will always be from the witness giving evidence in person. This is why a written account on its own is considered to be hearsay. And the hearsay rule says that hearsay evidence is inadmissible. It may not surprise you, however, that just like with many legal rules, there are exceptions. And when an exception applies to the hearsay rule, the evidence can be admitted and placed before the jury as evidence. And the exceptions to the hearsay rule for unavailable witnesses are contained in Section 116 of the Criminal Justice Act 2003, which permits a judge to allow hearsay evidence when a witness is unavailable for one of five reasons. And these are: 1, that the witness is dead; 2, the witness is unfit to be a witness because of their bodily or mental condition; 3, the witness is outside the United Kingdom and it's not reasonably practicable to secure their attendance; 4, the witness cannot be found, although such steps as it is reasonably practicable to take to find them have been taken; and 5, the witness will not give evidence through fear. In the last circumstance, fear, the statement can only be used where the court considers it's in the interests of justice to do so, taking into account the contents of their statement, any risk of unfairness to either side by admitting or excluding their evidence, whether special measures could be used to assist the witness, for example, giving evidence from behind a screen or from a remote location via video link, and finally, any other circumstances considered to be relevant. The party seeking to rely on hearsay evidence must make an application to the court, unsurprisingly known as a hearsay application. And this is something that the judge will look at the PTPH, in the sense of ensuring that if there are to be any hearsay applications, the party making them serves their hearsay application in good time before trial. Applications of this nature often being heard on the first day of trial, just before the prosecution opens its case. If hearsay is ruled as admissible under one of the five exceptions, the defence will, of course, make the point to the jury, as will the judge, that hearsay evidence has significant limitations. In particular, the statement was not made on oath, there has been no opportunity to cross-examine the witness, and the jury have been denied the opportunity to assess the demeanour of the witness as they gave their evidence. As it happens, In our case, there are no hearsay applications, since Daniel never gave a witness statement before he died, and no other factual witnesses are unavailable, at least not yet. So that's the prosecution case in terms of scientific evidence and witness evidence. The next thing the prosecution will turn to when reading into a case is what the defendant said in interviews, since this may narrow the areas in dispute and make it clearer what the issues are going to be at trial. As we know, in summary, Aidan said that he didn't do it. He didn't have a bottle and he was not the person responsible for bottling Daniel Clark. He claimed that Daniel Clark was responsible for confronting him outside and pushing, then punching him. He said that he'd acted in self-defence to repel this attack. He claimed that it was all a blur and he ran away in panic. In Bianca's prepared statement, she said that a person who can only be Daniel Clark had grabbed her on the dance floor, then pushed her boyfriend Aidan. She was clearly supporting Aidan. She mentioned that once outside, she saw Daniel pushing and assaulting Aidan, who was defending himself. She said that Daniel's friends, presumably Ethan and Finn, were shouting threats and a fight erupted. As for her part, she denied any involvement at all. So it's incumbent on the prosecution to prove her involvement and encouragement. It's also clear that if the trial were to pan out along the lines of this prepared statement, it's going to be suggested that the aggressors were Daniel, Ethan and Finn, that Aidan was simply a victim of this attack and Bianca no more than a bystander. That, however, does not explain how Daniel received such serious injuries. Even the prosecution think, if Aidan was acting in self-defence at one stage, how can it be considered necessary and reasonable self-defence to stick a broken bottle into someone's face? In many ways, the approach taken in interview by Connor was the same as Bianca. Daniel, Ethan and Finn were the aggressors. Aidan just defended himself and I, Connor, wasn't involved. So Aidan appears to be running the defence of self-defence and denying responsibility for smashing or using a bottle, and Bianca and Connor are running the defence of non-participation or encouragement. But again, how does that explain how Daniel received such serious injuries? Even though their case is far from perfect, the prosecution think they have enough evidence, at least on paper. Someone, clearly, was hiding something, and that was something to be explored at trial. Moving away from the interviews, I mentioned earlier that this case, which both the prosecution and defence will realise, is one where much will depend on the clarity and credibility of the evidence given by Ethan and Finn. They are crucial prosecution witnesses. It means that the prosecutor will look for any evidence or other information which may undermine their credibility, which in turn may affect how the jury views them, and which could mean that their evidence is less likely to be believed. The same applies to defendants, since if there's something which undermines them over and above the direct evidence in the case, it means there is a prospect that any account they give is less likely to be believed. Not only that, it may go further and suggest they're guilty of the offence. This is what's known as evidence of bad character. Bad character evidence often relates to a person's previous convictions or cautions, but can also relate to other evidence of what is referred to in sections 98 and 112 of the Criminal Justice Act 2003 as reprehensible behaviour, which often amounts to past conduct which would have amounted to a criminal offence, even though the defendant has no formal conviction relating to that behaviour. For example, if a man had been beating his partner up for years, but she'd never made a criminal complaint, and therefore no prosecution was ever brought, this would still amount to reprehensible behaviour within the meaning of bad character evidence. Importantly, bad character evidence doesn't concern the facts of the offence charged or anything to do with the investigation or prosecution of that offence, but rather is something distinct from these things. To use another example, if a person is charged with theft and they have 10 previous convictions for theft, then these previous convictions can be used as evidence of bad character to show that they have a propensity to commit offences of theft. To take yet another example, if a key prosecution witness in a case has a previous conviction for perverting the course of justice, the defence will almost certainly be permitted to use it to undermine their credibility. Since if they've sought to pervert the course of justice previously, what's to say they're not doing it now? Neither the prosecution nor the defence can rely on bad character evidence unless permission is granted by the judge. And for this, a bad character application needs to be made. And this is another matter which the judge will check at the PTPH. A bad character application to introduce the bad character of a defendant is made under Section 101 of the Criminal Justice Act 2003. This contains various grounds, or what are often referred to as gateways, through which bad character evidence can be presented as evidence at trial. There are, in fact, 7 gateways available, and they allow bad character evidence to be used against a defendant in the following situations. First, where the prosecution and defence agree to the evidence being used, and in cases involving multiple defendants, this includes agreement by all defendants. Second, where defendants choose to introduce their own bad character themselves at trial. Third, where it is what's known as important explanatory evidence, which is evidence which would substantially assist the jury's or magistrate's understanding of the case as a whole, and without which they would be unable to understand other evidence in the case. This usually relates to background evidence, which the prosecution require to put the case in context, such as how one defendant knows another, e.g. they were in prison together, or why a witness was frightened of the defendant and acted in a certain way, e.g. the defendant previously assaulted or bullied that witness. The fourth gateway is where the evidence is relevant to an important matter in issue between the prosecution and defence, including where the prosecution alleged that it demonstrates a propensity by the defendant to commit offences of the kind he is charged with, or a propensity to be untruthful. For example, where the prosecution wished to rely on a defendant's multiple previous convictions for similar offences, or committing offences in a particular way, or previous lies where this is relevant to the case being tried. In the case of the Crown and Hanson in 2005, the Court of Appeal considered this provision, deciding that there is no minimum number of events necessary to demonstrate a propensity, but the fewer the number of convictions, the weaker the evidence of propensity is likely to be, although a single previous conviction showing a tendency to unusual behaviour might be sufficient. The court said that evidence of bad character cannot be used simply to bolster a weak case or to prejudice the minds of a jury against a defendant. This gateway is only available to the prosecution, so can't be used by one defendant against another. However, the fifth gateway is where the bad character evidence intended to be introduced is relevant to an issue between two or more defendants at trial. This allows one defendant to make an application to introduce the bad character of a co-defendant, often where there is what's known as a cutthroat defence, i.e. each defendant blames the other. There's no cutthroat defence in Aidan, Bianca and Connor's case, well, at least not yet. The sixth gateway is for situations where the evidence would correct a false impression given by a defendant. So, for example, a defendant who describes himself when giving evidence as honest can have his previous convictions for dishonesty, such as theft or fraud, revealed to the court. The evidence used must go no further than is necessary to correct that false impression. And the seventh and final gateway can be used where the defendant has made an attack on the character of another person. This enables the prosecution to counter the attack and even things up by revealing the defendant's bad character. So, for example, accusing a witness of blatant dishonesty is likely to result in the defendant's own convictions for dishonesty being revealed. Simply denying an offence does not amount to attacking another person's character. It's worth noting that this gateway is only available to the prosecution. Those are the grounds or gateways in Section 101 to introduce a defendant's bad character. But in Section 100, there are 3 gateways that can be used to introduce bad character evidence against a non-defendant, such as against a defence or prosecution witness. In summary, these three gateways are, first, where it's important explanatory evidence, which has the same meaning I mentioned earlier, i.e. evidence which would substantially assist the jury's understanding of the case as a whole, and without which they would be unable to understand other evidence in the case. Second, where the evidence has substantial value in proving a matter in issue and is of substantial importance in the context of the case as a whole. For example, where the defence is self-defence, this could be used to introduce the complainant's previous convictions for assault to demonstrate his violent nature. Or in a case where the honesty of the witness is an issue, it could be used by a defendant to introduce the witness's previous convictions for dishonesty. Thirdly and finally, bad character evidence can be introduced against a non-defendant where the prosecution and defence agree to that evidence being used. In cases involving multiple defendants, this includes agreement by all defendants. As I mentioned, Ethan and Finn are crucial witnesses, and the prosecution will hope that there are no previous convictions on their records. Sadly, they're wrong. At least they're wrong so far as Finn is concerned, since Finn has one previous conviction recorded against him for sexual assault, an offence from 3 years ago when he was 19, and had sexually assaulted a girl of the same age at a party by grabbing hold of her breasts and rubbing himself against her. He had pleaded guilty at the first opportunity and was made the subject of a community order for a period of 18 months, with a rehabilitation activity requirement and an unpaid work requirement for 100 hours. He completed both requirements without issue. The prosecution know that if the jury gets to hear about this, it will hardly do Finn any favours, since the jury will almost certainly, at the very least, dislike him for it and perhaps turn against his evidence. On the other hand, the prosecution and the defence, of course, wonder how an application to get this previous conviction before the jury will succeed, i.e. what gateway is available to the defence. They only have three gateways available under Section 100. At first, it's difficult to see how this can be important explanatory evidence, i.e. evidence which would substantially assist the jury's understanding of the case as a whole, and without which they would be unable to understand other evidence in the case. Having said that, the defence team for Aidan decide to use this gateway, contending that sexual assault is the exercise of power and control over another individual, and therefore it goes to the heart of this witness's character. It's therefore, they say, important explanatory evidence. It would substantially assist the jury in understanding the case as a whole, and the jury would find it impossible to understand all the evidence in the case without it. As for the next gateway, fundamentally the same argument is used, that this conviction is of substantial value in proving a matter in issue, i.e. that Aidan was under attack, and is of substantial importance in the context of the case as a whole, i.e. that Finn is a man who has exercised power and control over an individual before, and he was seeking to do the same when attacking Aidan. These are the grounds which Aidan pursues, and his defence team put a bad character application together in the hope of getting Finn's conviction before the jury, an application which the prosecution will strongly resist. The final gateway for non-defendant's bad character requires agreement, and there is zero chance of the prosecution agreeing for this evidence to go before the jury. Fortunately for the prosecution, neither Ethan nor Daniel have any previous convictions or cautions, so this at least leaves them free from that area of attack on their characters. Turning to the bad character of the defendants, the prosecution put together an application to introduce the bad character of both Aidan and Connor. Against Aidan, they rely on his previous convictions for ABH and common assault, both offences of violence, to suggest he has a propensity for violence, and which therefore supports the suggestion that he used unlawful violence against Daniel. The application also makes reference to the fact that Aidan ran the defence of self-defence, which was disbelieved at his trial, and therefore he has a propensity to be untruthful about defending himself, a claim he's now making in this case. Finally, The prosecution contend that the ABH conviction shows a propensity to use violence against others when in the company of his co-defendant and friend Connor. Or alternatively, that this is important explanatory evidence which the jury need to know to assess the case as a whole. Against Connor, the prosecution also seek to rely on his recently discovered conviction for ABH, saying this shows a propensity to use violence against others when in the company of his co-defendant and friend Aidan, since the facts show they were together when this occurred. The prosecution also run, as they're entitled to, a second argument alongside this, that this amounts to important explanatory evidence, which the jury need to know to assess the case as a whole. The judge will look over all of these applications at the PTPH and direct that they are heard on the first day of the trial. To move on from bad character evidence, another matter the judge will check at the PTPH is whether there are any applications for what are known as special measures. Special measures are used to assist usually young or otherwise vulnerable witnesses or defendants to give evidence. For example, a witness to a serious assault may be fearful of appearing in court as a witness in front of the defendant and perhaps that defendant's supporters in the public gallery. An obvious special measure for a witness in this situation would be to allow them to give their evidence from behind a screen, such that only the judge, barristers, and jury could see them. There are, in fact, multiple special measures that can be used in court. These include pre-recorded evidence in chief and cross-examination of witnesses, which is a video recording carried out before the trial, which avoids the need for the witness to be present in open court. Another special measure is a live video link for a witness, which is often used in conjunction with pre-recorded evidence in chief, allowing a witness to avoid going into open court and for their cross-examination to take place via a live video feed from a separate location. I've already mentioned how a witness can be screened, but another special measure which can be permitted is to allow a witness to give their evidence in private, which means the public gallery being cleared when there is fear of intimidation. A special measure for both witnesses and defendants is the use of what are known as intermediaries, who are people who can help a vulnerable witness or defendant with communication. And in addition to this, special measures in the form of communication aids can be used in court, such as dolls and drawings. If it makes it easier for a witness to give their evidence, the judge can also direct the removal of wigs and gowns in the Crown Court to make the atmosphere less formal for vulnerable witnesses or defendants. That's just an overview of special measures, but the reality in Aidan, Connor and Bianca's case is that no special measures are being sought, either for the prosecution witnesses or the defendants. So that means, at least, that a few less applications need to be made to the court. All of this has taken us through the fundamental steps required in putting together the prosecution case and the various applications which need to be made before the trial, and which, at the plea and trial preparation hearing, the judge will ensure are in hand. So, when the prosecution serves its case, it will include the indictment, followed by the statements of witnesses, including Ethan and Finn, and of the police officers, the streamlined forensic reports, and the medical evidence. Then will come the exhibit section, which here will include summaries of each defendant's interview under caution. After the exhibits, there's one final section, and this is titled Unused Material. It's the material which the prosecution is not relying upon as part of its case, but which it's under a duty to disclose because it's capable of undermining the prosecution case or assisting the case for the defence. Disclosure will, at a later time, play an important part in this case, and I'll leave a more detailed explanation of it until then. Suffice it to say, for now, the unused material contains details of Finn's previous conviction for sexual assault, as well as the statements of the nightclub doorman, George Ingram and Harvey Jenkins, as well as details of their extensive previous convictions. So let's now move forward in time. On the day the PTPH is heard, Aidan, Bianca and Connor return to court. The indictment is put to each of them and all plead not guilty to the single count of murder. After giving directions and confirming the trial date, the case is then adjourned for trial. Aidan and Connor return to custody and Bianca is released on bail. One direction that the lawyers for all three defendants will need to comply with soon is to serve what are known as defence statements, which set out details of the defence they intend to run at trial. And in the next episode, we'll see exactly what they say. Because in the next episode, we go to trial. The start of the case, which will determine whether Aidan, Bianca and Connor are convicted of the offence of murder. But before I leave this episode, I want to mention something of significance that happened after Bianca left court following the PTPH. What she'd not noticed was Ethan Green, one of the key witnesses in the case, watching her from the public gallery. As she walked outside from the court building, she also failed to see Ethan, by that stage standing there with other friends staring at her, although Finn, the other key witness, wasn't present at that time. And what she then didn't see was Ethan running at her, although she'll later recall hearing the sound of footsteps fast approaching behind her just before it happened. And then, for Bianca, all went blank. What happened was witnessed by many people outside the court building. Ethan ran up behind Bianca and, using as much force as he could muster, punched her in the left side of her face. She collapsed to the ground, unconscious, as he shouted over her, "You murdering bitch." Of all places to commit a crime, doing so outside a court can almost guarantee capture within moments. As most people would expect, police officers and court security ran outside and Ethan was promptly arrested on suspicion of causing actual bodily harm. And Bianca was taken to hospital by ambulance. When the senior Crown prosecutor at the CPS, who now had responsibility for the murder case against Aidan, Bianca and Connor, heard about what had happened, she simply put her head in her hands. Until next time, thank you for listening, and I hope you are able to join me for episode 7. In the meantime, please like and subscribe, and I'll see you all soon.